Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James S. Henry of the Tax Justice Network, who assesses the significance of the leaked Panama Papers documents that expose how some politicians in the world's wealthiest people hide their money in tax shelters. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who explains why he believes sea level rise linked to climate change is on track to occur faster and at higher levels than previous estimates. And Margrethe Strand, Executive Vice President of Public Citizen, who talks about the Democracy Awakening actions in Washington, D.C., demanding legislative reforms to rein in the corrupting influence of big money in U.S. politics. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
McClatchy Newspapers reports that there's a new and growing dissident activist network that sprung up in Cuba since President Barack Obama initiated warmer relations with that island nation 15 months ago. They say people are more willing to voice their frustrations as they see an opening for change in the relationship with the United States. That growth is in part the reason for the step-up in the Cuban government's crackdown on dissidents that was evident during President Obama's 48-hour visit to the island. Dozens of activists were arrested before Obama's arrival. However, many activists are not actually jailed, but are held briefly or given house arrest. William Leo Grand, co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba, says fear may be too strong a word to describe the Cuban government's concerns about its new relationship with the United States, but he said it's undoubtedly the case that Cuban leaders want to impress upon dissidents that the opening doesn't mean they'll tolerate activity they regard as subversive. At a joint press conference with Obama during his visit, Cuban leader Raul Castro rejected the idea posed by reporters that his government had imprisoned anyone for speaking out against the government. He countered by saying that Cuba had honored the most sacred rights, the ones guaranteeing universal health care, education, and equal pay for women in the workplace. Castro called on the United States to abandon the Guantanamo Bay military base and to lift the U.S. embargo against Cuba. He said relations would never be fully normal until both these things were accomplished. With sinking global oil prices, Angola, Africa's second-largest oil producer, is seeking a bailout from the International Monetary Fund. Already in 2016, Angola's currency, the Kwanza, has fallen 16% due to low oil prices, and government spending has dropped by 20%. The West African nation had borrowed heavily from China and its former colonizer, Portugal. Angola is now seeking a three-year bailout that could exceed $8 billion. The IMF is expected to impose new austerity measures in Angola, limiting the prospects for future growth. Currently, oil production accounts for 95% of Angola's exports and over half of all government revenue. 50% of Angola's 24 million people live in extreme poverty, despite the nation's oil wealth. Angola's move reflects the growing stresses being felt by oil producers across the developing world that have been hit hard by a collapse in crude oil prices and are now struggling to plug the gaps left by dwindling revenues. Countries ranging from Azerbaijan to Nigeria have in recent months been engaging in discussions with the IMF, World Bank, and other multilateral institutions over how to cope with the oil price fallout. Massive budget cuts by outgoing Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal have put the state's public defender system in peril. The cuts to legal services are so severe that it has endangered the right to a fair trial for poor criminal defendants. The budget for public defenders in the Bayou State will be slashed by 61% in fiscal year 2017, creating unmanageable caseloads where attorneys are unable to consult with every defendant who needs representation. In response, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit to compel the state legislature to adequately fund the public defender system. Governor Jindal came into office with a $1 billion surplus driven by high oil prices, but the conservative governor and failed presidential candidate followed the Republican playbook of cutting taxes for the wealthy and exempting corporations from paying income tax, a strategy that resulted in Louisiana's $2 billion deficit. According to the American Prospect magazine, a shortage of public defenders is forcing many presumed innocent defendants to be warehoused in overcrowded jails without benefit of counsel. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Most of our listeners will have heard of or read about a set of leaked confidential files known as the Panama Papers, 11.5 million documents that provide detailed information on the shareholders and directors of more than 214,000 offshore corporations. The documents were leaked from the Panamanian-based law firm Mossack Fonseca that assists some of the world's richest people and corporations to establish shell companies in low-tax haven nations used to conceal wealth. The names of 140 politicians from more than 50 countries linked to secret offshore accounts in the documents have thus far included the Prime Minister of Iceland, who was forced to resign, Pakistan's Prime Minister, the Presidents of Argentina and Ukraine, the King of Saudi Arabia, senior Chinese officials, and some close associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin. British Prime Minister David Cameron's father was also connected to a Panamanian offshore account. An anonymous source originally provided the Panama Papers to a German newspaper in early 2015. But due to the overwhelming volume of documents, the editors sought help from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which distributed the data to 400 journalists at 107 media outlets across the world. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Here he assesses the significance of the leaked Panama Papers documents, which represents just the tip of the iceberg of where the world's wealthiest people and corporations hide their money in tax shelters.
Well, this is by far the largest leak in history. We've had 214,438 companies that were set up by this company and the documents associated with those. The clients are from 200 countries, and they include, so far, we've identified about 22 current heads of state, 143 people in political office, quite a few family members who are associated closely with current or former heads of state, and quite a few people on the Fortune 500 list. So it's an incredible accumulation of influential people. This case is about kleptocracy in terms of public officials helping themselves to public assets or having offshore wealth that they can't explain, maybe due to corruption and bribery. And for many countries, especially in the developing world, kleptocracy is a more important issue. You know, corruption is a more important issue than just tax dodging.
I wonder if you could explain to our audience how the Mossack Fonseca revelations fit into the global tax avoidance that you've estimated at between $21 and $32 trillion in private wealth in offshore tax havens. And that doesn't include the trillions of dollars more in wealth hidden by many global corporations.
That's right, and it doesn't include non-financial assets like real estate, yachts, art collections. I mean, the tax angle to this, you know, our estimates are as of 2010. What we've seen since then is that the numbers for the worldwide haven industry have grown even farther, especially from countries like Russia and China, which have been in the last two or three years subject to a huge amount of capital outflow, and you know, $1 trillion from China in the last 18 months. Russia probably has more than 1.3 trillion offshore. Argentina, Latin America, leading Latin American countries have more than 2.5 trillion offshore, which is more than twice their external debt. So a lot of this is motivated by taxation, but it's also motivated by political risk, kind of the ruling elite. And, you know, but I think what you have to imagine is something like the Star Wars bar scene, where you have the drug dealers, the tax dodgers, the kleptocrats, the people worried about being raided by the political police, you know, all gathered around using the same basic facilities, which are offshore companies and trusts that are very easy to set up in other people's names with nominee directors. There's one lady who is a secretary for Fonseca listed as a director for 24,000 letterbox companies that were set up, all of them owned by non-residents of Panama. So it's this financial secrecy kind of facility, the lack of any registration of so-called beneficial owners, so we don't know who owns what. And I think that's one big contributor to this, but it's also this network of basically unscrupulous law firms, banks, and accounting firms that are channeling all of this business to these people and the public officials that have failed for 40 years to crack down on this.
Well, just a final quick one here. What would be the top actions that you would like to see the U.S. government take in coalition with other governments around the world to close off these tax loopholes and make the playing field more even for all taxpayers?
The International Commission with subpoena power, like they have in Guatemala, I'd like to have beneficial ownership registration in the public register so we tell who owns what. I'd like to have public officials have to release their tax returns and declare their offshore and onshore wealth. And I'd like to have tougher penalties for the banks and other enablers that are in this business. And I'd like to have a blacklist for havens that keep getting caught doing this over and over again, like Panama and to some extent like Delaware.
That was James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network. Find more perspectives and analysis on the Panama Papers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former NASA climate scientist James Hansen is one of the world's leading experts on climate change. He testified before Congress back in 1988 that global warming was already occurring due to the burning of fossil fuels, becoming one of the first scientists to go on record. He now works at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and in late March published an important paper in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics titled Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms, Evidence from Paleoclimate Data, Climate Modeling, and Modern Observations that 2 degrees centigrade global warming could be dangerous. The paper posits that sea level rise is on track to occur faster and at higher levels than more conservative estimates, like that of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, have predicted. An agreement signed by 195 countries in Paris last year seeks to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but it's not remotely ambitious enough to limit global warming to the degree Dr. Hansen regards as necessary. Hansen is party to a lawsuit against the federal government filed by the group Our Children's Trust for not protecting young people and future generations from the ravages of climate change. On April 8th, the judge ruled in favor of the 21 youthful plaintiffs, which moves their lawsuit one step closer to trial. Hansen visited Yale University April 6th through the 8th as the Yale Climate Change and Health Initiative's climate change leader in residence. What follows are excerpts from his April 7th talk at Yale, where Dr. Hansen discussed his new study. He uses the term paleoclimate to refer to studies of the climate dating back hundreds of thousands of years. The term forcing refers to anything that forces the climate system to go out of equilibrium, resulting either in an increase in temperature or a decrease, which is called a negative forcing.
I think the climate response function of models, of climate models, is too lethargic compared to the real world. You know, the paleoclimate evidence tells us that when ice sheets disintegrate, they can disintegrate quite rapidly and give you several meters of sea level rise in a century, even though the forcings that caused those paleoclimate changes were much weaker than the human-made forcing. I argue that when the ice sheets disintegrate, it's going to be a very nonlinear process. and is probably better characterized by a doubling time than it is by a more linear assumption. But we don't know what the characteristic time would be. So I just try, I just say, let's assume that there's up to 5 meters of sea level rise. There's ice equivalent to that, which is vulnerable to contact with the ocean. Because the threat of rapid sea level rise is caused by the fact that parts of the ice sheets are in contact with the ocean. And that ocean water can cause relatively rapid melting of ice shelves. And once ice shelves are melted, then the ice sheets can discharge icebergs to the ocean much more rapidly. And there's at least 5 meters of sea level rise in the West Antarctic plus parts of the East Antarctica and parts of Greenland that is vulnerable to rapid change. So it depends on what we do with our fuel use. If we stay on business as usual, and right now, as long as fossil fuels are allowed to be the cheapest energy, then regardless of these statements that were made in Paris in December, those are practically worthless. If we stay on that path, then I see no way that we could avoid. I think we would get several meters of sea level rise this century. We say 50 to 150 years, but we have to keep our eye on Greenland and Antarctica the next several years and just see how that rate continues to change. But the question is, have we passed a point at which that it's inevitable that we're going to lose the West Antarctic ice sheet? I'm not sure about that, but this amplifying feedback in the Southern Ocean has to make you very concerned. We have to restore the planet's energy balance. As long as there's more energy coming in than going out, then ice is going to keep melting. And to restore the energy balance requires that we actually get CO2 to go down. And that's very hard, but that's what we're asking in the lawsuit that we filed against the federal government, or our Children's Trust has filed against it. We're asking the government to give a plan for how they're going to reduce emissions at a rate that would be consistent with restoring the planet's energy balance in a century. And if we did that, I think we probably could minimize sea level rises. We're not going to avoid it altogether.
An audience member asked, what is the role of methane in Dr. Hansen's climate modeling? Natural or fracked gas is composed mostly of methane, which creates 86 times more global warming, molecule for molecule, than carbon dioxide in the first 20 years after release.
Methane is actually quite important. The human-made methane increase also causes tropospheric ozone to increase and stratospheric water vapor to increase. And so when you include those indirect effects of methane, the forcing is about 7/10 of a watt per meter squared, which is at least as large as the planet's energy balance. So if we would just stop the emissions, human-made emissions of methane, we could restore the planet's energy balance if CO2 then all stayed the same. It's a big factor, because the reason that you could restore it is that the methane lifetime is only about 10 or 12 years. So it would go back to its pre-industrial level. So it has to be a part of the plan for how you're going to restore the planet's energy balance. But unless we get CO2 under control, that methane knob is just not powerful enough. So I don't emphasize it. You've got to make policymakers think of the major knob, and that's the CO2 knob.
That was an excerpt of a talk by climate scientist Dr. James Hansen, delivered at Yale University on April 7th. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find links to Hansen's latest study and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the almost daily bombast and insults emanating from Republican presidential candidate and real estate billionaire Donald Trump, the 2016 election campaign has been more a source of crude media entertainment than an informed national debate about public policy and the future of the country. But while cable news channels and other commercial media outlets trip over themselves to fill the airwaves with Trump-related content to cash in on ratings-driven profits, the American people have come to believe that the U.S. political system is broken. In a recent public opinion poll conducted by Gallup in March of this year, some 66% of those surveyed believe that the U.S. presidential election process is dysfunctional and in need of repair. One major factor contributing to Americans' loss of faith in the nation's machinery of democracy is an overwhelming bipartisan rejection of the 2010 Supreme Court Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. politics, where a handful of billionaires now have unchecked power to influence election outcomes. With so much disgust at the way U.S. politics is run, and the 2016 election campaign on track to be the most expensive in U.S. history, a coalition of more than 260 groups are supporting a series of protests in Washington, D.C., called Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening, April 11th through the 18th. Their activists are demanding voting rights reforms, the overturning of Citizens United, and the filling of the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy. The actions, which kicked off on April 2nd, with a march from Philadelphia to Washington, will include teach-ins, rallies, direct action, and will culminate on April 18th with mass civil disobedience at the U.S. Capitol building. Your reporter spoke with Margretta Strand, Public Citizens Executive Vice President, a Democracy Awakening Coalition partner, who talks about the corrupting influence of big money in U.S. politics and the goals of the Democracy Awakening protest.
A lot of things that are happening right now, a lot of excitement, lots of grassroots people. I was up at the rally today. People had flown in from Denver and Seattle, sort of pretty much every state being represented. We're expecting thousands of people here this coming weekend, and it's pretty exciting. We're coming together on three demands that are sort of core to our democracy: get big money out of politics, restore voting rights, and have a vote on the Supreme Court nominee. And our website is democracyawakening.org, which has a lot of information about what's being planned.
Tell us a little bit about what ties all these issues together: confronting the failure of U.S. politics to address key issues, the machinery of elections, which a lot of people feel is suspect or a failed project in many respects, as well as the economy, which is failing most people. All these things seem to be linked in my mind, maybe many of our listeners' mind, and that, I think, is one of the major elements of bringing all these groups together that you've put together here in this week of actions.
At the bottom of what we're trying to do, whether you care about climate change or whether you're in a, you know, fighting for your union, and whether you're talking about healthcare or immigration, I think more and more people are starting to see that we cannot make progress on those issues when the system is rigged in the way it is right now, where the very few, very wealthy pour unlimited amount of money into the political system, where we're going backwards on voting rights, and where we have a Congress that is completely broken at this point, the point of obstructions that we see now, what we see happening around the Supreme Court, and so forth. And we're left with this election cycle that is reduced to pretty meaningless discussions oftentimes. And so I think what we're trying to do is bring some of these issues back into the front. You know, we, Public Citizen, did a report earlier this week talking about how in none of the debates in the presidential race has there been a conversation about money in politics. What would you as a candidate do about Citizens United? How do you see the role of money playing? How can we make change? None of those questions are coming up. The fact that people's right to vote is being jeopardized, all of these questions are not being talked about. And that's what we feel are the important underpinnings of everything we try to do. We have 270 organizations that are part of Democracy Awakening, from the all the spectrums of different issues. Why? Because we have to deal with these issues to make progress on any of the other things that we're working on. So that's part of what's exciting with the thousands of people that will be coming, with all these groups working together. It's really creating a movement for some of these very fundamental issues that we have to address.
Tell us about some of the varied organizations and types of groups that are involved in the coalition that's put Democracy Awakening together.
It's anything from big unions like the AFL-CIO and SEIU to smaller groups. Jim Hightower is going to be there, Friends of the Earth Sierra Club. We have Southern Illinois People for Progress. I'm just looking at the website. So it's a really great mix, the NAACP, Common Cause Public Citizen. It's a big mix of both small and large, national and local, from every kind of issue area that, you know, you can sort of imagine, that's coming together, and it's all listed on our website. Part of what's exciting is, you know, these are groups who don't necessarily work on these issues as their core issue. You know, if you're the Sierra Club, you wake up in the morning and you want to address climate change. But now they're not able to really do that. And I think the fact that large organizations are starting to see that we also need to work on money and politics, we also need to work on voting rights if we're going to have an impact on climate, that's what you see reflected in these 270 groups that are participating.
As you look at electoral politics in this country and how change is made in our own history and history around the world, it seems pretty clear that movements make change and elections rarely make change. That's my view anyway. What's your perspective on building a movement and its importance to make the changes that our elections often really aren't capable of doing?
Well, no, I mean, I completely agree with you. And part of what I think it's exciting about people coming together in Washington this weekend is not that there's a protest in D.C., what I think is exciting is that it is actually genuinely building on a movement that has been growing around the country for years. This is sort of the ground war, right, where you're sort of building your coalition, you're getting more and more people engaged, you're creating that nationally, you're taking it out around the country. People on the ground are moving things forward, and that does lead to change.
That was Margretta Strand, Executive Vice President with Public Citizen. Find more information on the Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening protest actions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.